There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 233. I'm really excited about this show. It was inspired by a hearing conducted by a subcommittee in Congress in December of 2014. They talked to a number of people about what they would need to enable the development of advanced reactors in the United States. So I decided to gather a group of innovators who are working in that area and have a discussion with them. So with me tonight, I've got a pretty good representative sampling of the innovators who are looking at trying to build new nuclear and advanced nuclear here in the United States and North America. My guests tonight are Mike Magu, the Chief Commercial Officer of NuScale Power. NuScale has developed the NuScale Power Module, which is approximately 50 megawatts electric output. The concept design for their first plant would be to put 12 of those individual modules, each of which is a complete power unit with a heat source and a turbine generator and a containment. And all of the 12 modules and their containment, individual containments, would go into a shared 8 million gallon below grade pool of water, which acts as the ultimate heat sink. Also, I have David LeBlanc, President and Chief Technical Officer of Terrestrial Energy, and Cannon Bryant, who's the Chief Financial Officer for Terrestrial Energy. Terrestrial Energy has developed a molten salt cooled reactor. It uses low-enriched uranium as a fuel cycle. The reactor modules have the primary heat transfer system is designed to operate for 4 years and then be replaceable with the used unit would go into a silo and cool down. The new unit would be turned on and operate for another 4 years, and then the unit's been cooling for 4 years to go into a longer-term storage. Robin Rickman, who's the director of Westinghouse's Small Modular Reactor Program, they've got a 225 megawatt electric passively safe modular reactor, uses many of the same concepts, techniques, methodologies that were developed for the AP1000 and the AP600 before that. The design is ready to go. It's on the shelf waiting for an investment decision. Robin tells me that somewhere from the day that the investment decision is made until the design is ready for a design certification application, the NRC, is about 12 months. But the investment decision has not been made yet because the company doesn't see the lineup of customers waiting for it. Per Peterson, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, he's the faculty lead for a team that's designed a pebble bed, fluoride salt-cooled, high-temperature reactor in partnership with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Their design concept is pretty innovative. It includes a nuclear heat source, which is a pebble bed reactor, solid fuel that's cooled by molten salt. It doesn't contain any fuel material in the molten salt. The molten salt flows to the reactor and goes to a heat exchanger where it transfers its heat to air, and the air is used to power a Brayton cycle gas turbine that has a combined cycle system. It's got a Rankine cycle steam turbine as a bottoming cycle. In a configuration with just nuclear heat, the system will produce about 100 megawatts electric, but they also have a capability to add natural gas heating, which would increase the power output to as high as 242 megawatts electric for peaking power from that 100 megawatt unit. The overall plant concept is to put 12 units on a single site for a 1200 megawatt baseload power plant with just nuclear. They can peak up to 2900 megawatts if you add natural gas for the reheat cycle. And the final participant is Jacob DeWitt, who is the CEO of U-Power, which has designed a solid-state microreactor that produces about a megawatt with the and has the capability of co-generating process heat. Pretty wide variety of unique designs and people with different skill sets. And now I'm going to introduce them individually and let them tell you a little about themselves and allow you to match the voices with the names for the rest of the show. And first up is Mike Magoo, the Chief Commercial Officer for NuScale Power.
Thanks, Rod. Yeah, it's Mike Magoo, and I'm glad to have a chance to participate in this radio show. I've often been told that I have a really good radio face, and especially tonight on Oscar night, I actually thought I was probably going to be at the Oscars since the NuScale power module was the only new nuclear technology featured in Pandora's Promise, but unfortunately, we weren't graced with a nomination, so I'm joining you tonight. But with a little background on NuScale, NuScale has been developing our technology for 15 years, and we have had a one-third scale prototype operational since 2003. So our technology is fairly well along in the advanced stages of development. We were awarded a Department of Energy Small Modular Reactor grant, and we are the only remaining small modular reactor company continuing with the development of our technology and with a customer committed for the procurement and operation of the plant. Our first plant is slated for commercial operation in Idaho in 2023. We expect to submit our design certification next year. We currently have 600 people on the project, and we are spending about $12 million a month. And Rod did ask me to just mention what the triple crown of nuclear safety is, and that specifically is a key component of our design, which allows that if faced with a Fukushima-like station blackout event, our plant shuts itself down and cools itself off forever, as opposed to some other designs that speak about 72-hour coping periods or 6 or 7 days. Ours is indefinite. It's forever, with no operator action, with no AC or DC power, no emergency diesel generators, no Class 1E battery systems, and no additional water other than the common pool that the NuScale power modules are installed in. So that's the NuScale power triple crown of safety. And that's a brief background of where we are. Thanks, Rod.
David LeBlanc, President, Chief Technical Officer, and pretty much the inventor of the technology at NuScale, at Terrestrial Energy.
Yeah, thanks, Rod. David LeBlanc here. I'm very happy to be on your show. Just very briefly, Terrestrial Energy is a company. It's a new company that's trying to develop old technology, molten salt reactors. Where first reactor was back in 1954. Main development was in the 60s and 70s. The true heyday of nuclear development. But in a sense, it was technology left on the shelf. That we are really, molten salt reactors just have enormous potential. They're quite different than traditional designs, mainly that it's a liquid fuel concept, but just pretty much in every category you can imagine, from cost to waste production to safety, just it has great potential. And our focus has been to, in every way possible, to simplify. We're not making the perfect reactor. We're not making the Ferrari of reactors, but we're trying to design a reactor that can be built in a reasonable time frame that will interest investors, the private sector. But even in their simplest embodiments, they're still quite impressive. But we can discuss specifics later. That's pretty much all we can all start with for now.
All right. Thank you, David. And Cannon, you're from Terrestrial Energy as well. But I invited you mainly because I want to have some financial input in this discussion. So go ahead and give a little brief introduction about you and your involvement with Terrestrial Energy.
Thanks very much indeed, Rod. I'm trained as an accountant, and I have been in the finance industry for over 20 years, mainly in the natural resource space. I got started in nuclear in 2004. I co-founded a company called Uranium Energy Corp, which we started from scratch, and within a couple of years, we were listed on the New York Stock Exchange. We raised over $100 million. And began production of a uranium mine in the state of Texas. From there, my interest in nuclear sort of migrated over to the technology side, became very interested in advanced nuclear technologies. And I actually looked around for 5 years, down to a lot of dead ends and a lot of misfires. And before I came across David LeBlanc and the molten salt reactor technology, and I was just convinced that this is the only thing that I've seen around which has a real chance of being a new nuclear technology that can be commercial in a period of time which is acceptable to investors. And that's really the difficult thing if you are trying to bring a project to market, and it's nuclear, and it's new, and it's financed by private industry. It has to be done in a time frame that's acceptable. So the IMSR, as David pointed out, is very commercial, and one of the key differences about Terrestrial is that we are not pursuing licensing in the United States. We are not. We are not going down the NRC pathway. We are, in fact, pursuing licensing of our demonstration plant in Canada with the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission. This is a very, very different regulatory pathway, very different from the NRC. The CNSC applies a non-deterministic style of regulation for nuclear. And this process, this pathway, will allow us to be have our commercial demonstration ready by the early 2020s.
Okay, Ken, we'll discuss a little bit more about that decision process that you guys that Terrestrial Energy went through to decide where to focus your initial efforts. All right, next up is Robin Rickman, who was the director of Westinghouse's Small Modular Reactor Program. Robin.
Thank you, Rod. This is Robin Rickman from Westinghouse. I think, Rod, you provided a very good snapshot earlier into the Westinghouse Small Modular Reactor, so I won't repeat any of that. I would just like to add a bit in terms of what we are doing today, just to ensure it's characterized correctly. And it's easiest to talk about what we're not doing. And what we're not doing is we've purposefully chosen to not advance the state of the design or the state of the engineering necessary for the plant any further at this point. And with that, we've made the decision to not advance the licensing activities associated with the Westinghouse Small Modular Reactor at the same time. And as you said, Rod, we believe we're about 12 months away from being able to submit a design certification application to the US NRC. when we do make that decision to push forward with the engineering and the licensing activities for the plant. And just as you said, it's really because the plant is founded on our AP1000 licensed technology. So it does put us quite a ways down the road in terms of the actual plant design and the necessary engineering for ultimately receiving the design certification for the plant. So that's where we're at today. We are still actively participating with NEI and EPRI and ANS and the other industry groups to provide input and what support we can to ensure that the industry, at least within the U.S., moves towards success. So that's where we're at today. And I'm very pleased and excited to be here tonight.
Great. Next up is Per Peterson, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He hosted me at UCB just a couple of weeks ago. Per?
Thank you, Rod. It's a real pleasure to be able to contribute and also to be able to join with a group of people who are all contributing to advancing innovation in the area of nuclear energy. We're a university, so we have a number of different things that we do. We educate nuclear engineering students, and we're trying to give them a set of tools that they can use so that they can go out and make a difference. One of, the key things that is quite interesting about the students, we're recruiting these days extraordinarily gifted students coming into this field. And I don't think it's not really because they think they can get rich working in the field of nuclear engineering, but instead it's because they think that they can make a difference in the future because it's an important area of technology. So over the last 15 to 20 years at Berkeley, we've worked on a number of areas that are important to nuclear reactor technology. For example, we worked on understanding how non-condensable gases can affect the condensation of steam, which is a very important phenomena in the design of passive containment safety systems for advanced light water reactors. And in fact, the work that we did ended up being used in helping with the licensing of AP600 and 1000, as well as the ESBWR. What we're really interested in at this point is where are the most important areas where teaching and research can contribute to accelerating innovation in nuclear energy. And I think that we should be looking for examples of best practice, not just within our field, but elsewhere also. So there's a number of things. The transition towards being able to license reactors with passive safety and the methodologies for doing that, such as the use of integral effects testing, which provides the basis for the AP1000 as well as the new scale designs and all of the other passive safety systems that are being proposed for the new SMRs. I think the business model behind SMR is also important, as well as the major advances in modular construction, particularly the things that have been Westinghouse has been doing with the steel concrete composites. These are all examples of best practice. Right now, what we're focusing in on is the question of how we might be able to develop reactors that would use molten salts as coolants. And it's a fairly long conversation to discuss all of the dimensions of the molten salts, but they have certain attributes that make them very interesting as coolants and potentially also as the liquid fuels for use in reactors, such as chemical stability and intrinsically low pressure. What we've been doing at Berkeley is working to develop in collaboration with MIT and University of Wisconsin, as well as Oak Ridge and Idaho National Labs, the technical basis to design relatively simple reactors that would use molten salts, and these would be solid fuels. The key thing that we can do going down this path is to make use of a lot of the experience in developing passive safety for light water reactors and translate it to these molten salt technologies can operate at higher temperature. And in fact, we've just been commissioning an integral effects test similar in its scaling to the APEX and NASLR facilities that Oregon State University had. And we're starting to develop data that will allow us to understand and predict transient response of passive safety for these salt-cooled high-temperature reactors. And in this process, of course, one of our major goals is to train students, to educate students so that they can go out and contribute to these different companies and really accelerate the basis for in having a lot more innovation occur in this field than really has happened, say, in the last 60 years or so.
Yeah, matter of fact, one of the students that I met when I was out there at UCB, I believe interned for NuScale Power this last summer, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. Grant Buster was up there, and you know, we really admire what NuScale's accomplished. We have another company that was founded by Bill Gates that's been grabbing up a bunch of our graduates, and I think that the key thing that we're trying to do is to give them a set of skills and a different way of looking at how to tackle these problems that will allow them to go out and enable innovation to happen and to reduce the time scales for developing the technology. This is, I think, one of the most important reasons that getting small modular reactors developed and the work that NuScale is doing, as well as hopefully Westinghouse can get restarted on. These smaller reactors, there will be market segments that will value these reactors for a variety of different reasons. But quite clearly, once you're working in the domain of smaller reactors, you also have the potential to introduce a lot more innovation a lot more rapidly. And while large reactors are clearly going to continue to be an important technology, the SMR area is where the most potential exists for us to make rapid advance in improving nuclear energy technology. And that's one of the reasons why I think you've got a great set of people together here for the discussion today.
All right, and we got one more who's got a really completely different design than what the rest of the people have, because they're looking at micro-scale reactors producing on the order of a megawatt versus tens or hundreds of megawatts. Jacob DeWitt, please tell us a little bit more about U-Power.
Sure. Thanks, Rod, and thanks for inviting me. It's an honor and a privilege to get to be a part of this group. So U-Power is a pretty early stage company, basically formed by some MIT graduates. 2013 is when we launched, although I've been working on this technology since 2012, early 2012. And the concept that we're pursuing is the idea of producing a very small reactor, like you said, on the order of single-digit megawatts, that's very well suited for certain markets that basically have a power demand that looks a lot like that, and right now rely mostly on diesel generators. And you think mostly these are off-grid markets, so smaller communities, sort of in either islands or more isolated areas, to mining, to oil and gas development, even, as well as some application possibly with the military and certain industrial uses as well. And the reason we kind of pursued this was because we saw a very strong customer interest in this market space. And we realized that it might be easier to get reactors built and sold in that size range for what we were trying to do than starting off a little bit bigger for what our technology is. And that's kind of how we came to focus on that. Also, just like Dr. Peterson was saying, was being small lets us do some things a little bit more quickly, a little more easily, so we can introduce some manufacturing technologies and techniques into the technology that we've been working on and developing and testing and have some expertise in, that can really cheapen the production of these kinds of reactors, so that we can build them more like we build cars, and less like we, of course, do them today, but even less than we do sort of if you were to build them like ships or airplanes, a little bit more automation, a little bit faster. But to get there, we got to start building stuff first. And we basically have been working a lot on doing at-scale power testing to make sure that our system, our cooling systems work as we expect them to. And we've been waiting on some of those results and some of the manufacturing testing as well before we start to you know, start pursuing, or I guess start opening up to a more public, like licensing and pre-licensing activities, I should say, and going down that path. So we've still got some work there as we finalize the exact size of our design based on the results we have. But, you know, I think it's a very exciting time to be in this field. I graduated from MIT with my PhD in June of last year. And I can tell you that when I was an undergrad 10 years before, the idea of what you would do as a nuclear engineer was pretty well laid out. And it's pretty exciting to now be able to sit here and with some of my fellow, I guess, formerly fellow students, be able to see all the different opportunities opening up. It's a really exciting time, so I'm excited to be a part of it.
You know, both Jacob and Per mentioned a little bit about the reasons why there's so much interest in going smaller, even in an industry that has always been governed sort of by the idea that the only way to, or the best way to make things cheaper is to achieve economy of scale by building bigger units. I've had a discussion on my blog recently about the importance of the economy of scale in building a big enough industry, creating enough different ways of thinking and enough different qualified parts suppliers to achieve some economies based on building more and more units vice building bigger and bigger units. So what I'd like to do here is I'll start with Mike and kind of go through the process that you guys had internally for picking a size for your initial development. Mike, why did NuScale say 45, 50 megawatts was about the right size?
So we got the output of a single NuScale power module is 50 megawatts, and the design of the plant is for to accommodate up to 12 50 megawatt modules. So that would be a gross output of 60 megawatts. Subtracting out house load, the full plant would net out at about 570. The reason that we arrived at that number, it was based on our customers. Everything we do in the design of the plant, how we approach licensing, the commercial offering is as a function of our advisory board, which is comprised by a group of 24 nuclear utilities and related firms who will likely be the future owners of the NuScale plant. So for us, it's really important that whatever we design and ultimately offer in the marketplace is reflective of what the marketplace wants. The arrival at a 12 module, 50 megawatt per module installation came from several significant prospective customers who were faced with looming coal plant cancellations. And if you do the math and you look at 180 megawatt coal plants, there's a lot of 180 megawatt coal plants that tend to be installed in increments of two or three per site. So if you had three of those in one location, that would be 540 megawatts. So some of our early, very active clients were looking at thinking about putting their coal plants on a glide path to dismantlement and decommissioning. And you can't set that platform on fire until you have a mechanism to replace that baseload. Those discussions started probably 6 years ago. With the recent advent of the EPA 111D discussions, and I met with EPA Administrator today, Gina McCarthy, and they're very active with a set of regulations that is going to put additional pressure on people who have baseload carbon generating assets. Now, what that rule looks like in terms of how it's been proposed and how it ultimately passes is anybody's guess, because there's been over 3 million comments provided. But suffice it to say that there will be continued pressure on carbon generation, and our prospective customers believe that the size that our plant is established at is suitable to replace those retired carbon-generating assets. So that's how we got to it.
And Mike, one more quick question. What is your number for N? How many units, how many modules do you guys have to produce before you reach the economies of your nth of a kind unit?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, again, since the first plant, and our first plant will be built in Idaho for the Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems, and they already have an oversubscription for a full 12 module installation. So with the first plant, we will reach N for the economies of and the efficiencies of scale for manufacturing NuScale power modules. And the NuScale power module is the containment and the reactor vessel in toto manufactured in a factory. So we don't have a field stick built containment building like most other proposed designs.
Okay, thank you very much. And so, Jacob, let's go to the other end of the scale. You said how did you pick 1 megawatt? Which, by the way, I just want to remind people that 1 megawatt sounds like a small number, but it's really 1,000 horsepower generator. I don't know what I was thinking. 1 megawatt is 1,341 horsepower, which is pretty good size for a diesel engine.
Right, yeah. So it was actually somewhat similar strategy to NuScale, but with, of course, a different customer sort of advice and advisory group. A lot focus on what the specific needs were for some of the folks who are buying power for some of these development corporations or some of these communities. And one of the things that really stuck out was they have power needs that are typically on the order of, 10 megawatts or less as sort of the kind of peak output level. Sometimes there's some fluctuation, but that's kind of where it is. And they don't like to have single generator risk. So they wanted to have more than one unit on site. And so talking to them, it kind of made a lot of sense to focus on a technology that was in that scale. Now, one of the things that we focused on is just developing a system that's basically like a nuclear thermal battery in the sense that it produces heat. And the reason we did that was because one of the really important pieces of feedback we got from talking to about a dozen or so of these groups that made this a point to bring up, there's another about a dozen on top of that didn't really talk about this, but these 12 or so potential customers and buyers were very adamant about a specific use of a power conversion technology based on either their experience or operational experience with it. So we realized we needed to make something that was somewhat flexible and how we could couple up to different power conversion systems. And we had to talk to vendors of those at that size. Now, being on the order of a megawatt or two makes it, a little easier to be able to buy sort of these kind of units on skids off the shelf. So steam turbines or open air Brayton cycles, or even in some case, organic Rankine cycles. But that kind of sets up a situation where you've got sort of a different constraint, and we needed to fit in something that made it a little easier to be able to kind of combine the ordering of those systems, those components, as well as ours. And so the sweet spot really was in the few megawatts range. And so, when we look at our reactor with different power conversion systems, we're between, 1 and a little over 2 megawatts, depending on what the technology ultimately is. And that seems to be a sweet spot for some of these groups. And like you said, a megawatt's small compared to on-grid power, but it's quite big when you really think about what it can do for some of these off-grid areas. Even on a neighborhood by neighborhood basis, it gives you a sense of scale. But that's kind of what led us to that decision, was really focusing on what people who are in this segment want in terms of their power generator.
All right, Robin, you're kind of at the high end of what's a small modular reactor. Not the highest end, of course, but pretty up there for a unit being about 225 megawatts of electricity. Can you help us understand Westinghouse's thought process there?
Absolutely, Rod. And we are up at that upper end of the 300 megawatt range. And when we first sat out on this journey, we thought about the customers just really like everybody else does. And in terms of what could we do with a small reactor to satisfy our customer needs, we knew that we really needed to reduce the overall cost of the plant. And I'm sure that everybody on the call tonight understands that the largest fraction of the plant cost for new nuclear construction is the financing cost, and that what has become 5, 6, 7, 8, sometimes 10 years of construction effort and the financing that comes with that is just untenable for most utility customers. So we started with the idea of how can we reduce that, and really quite quickly we realized that through a complete modular scheme for the entire plant, the nuclear island, all of the componentry, the turbine island, the balance of plant buildings and structures, if we could modularize all of those items and do it in a fashion with an assembly plan that would reduce the construction time or the assembly time, as some folks like to call it, to a much shorter duration and bring real certainty to that time period, we could really reduce the overall cost for utility customers, make nuclear a much more palatable option in terms of new generating build-out. So we got to that point, and it wasn't a matter of picking a power that would work. We started with what were the demands to be modular, and very simply put, it really took us to the reactor vessel, and how small did the reactor vessel have to be? What was the maximum size of the reactor vessel to be able to ship them over the road? So we determined that parameter and then worked our way out. And at the end of the day, we ended up with a reactor that produces as much power as we could possibly squeeze out of that reactor, because our utility customers they're trying to make money, and to make money by selling electricity, and their return on investment is much better if they can produce more power or more output from that plant for a given dollar. So we just put in as much power into that modular size that we could, and we're north of 225, but I really don't want to say exactly how far north we are, but we do aim to maximize the megawatts out of the plant for the amount of materials we need to buy to put into the plant. So that's really a very short story on how we arrived at the power level. And with that, as those pieces started to come together, it became pretty clear that, you know, we could not be everything to everybody. And at the end of the day, much like Mike was talking, the coal replacement really is the more of an ideal market segment for the Westinghouse SMR, simply due to its size for us. So a lot of the same thinking, but it really is around the modularity of the entire plant.
And one more question for you, Robin. I think I've read somewhere where the CEO, Danny Roderick, says that before you all want to move forward in this scheme of having all of these modules be able to be built in factories and assembled together, you need to have a pretty decent sized order book before that investment makes sense. What's the number that you want to see in your path before you say, okay, man, now it's going to make sense for us to start investing in building out this factory infrastructure that's going to allow us to assemble what we think is the right system for the customer?
That's a really good question, Rod. The number that Danny Roderick mentioned just about a year ago now, if I recall correctly, was at least 30 plants in an order book for this to make sense. But let me just add that Westinghouse doesn't intend as a company to really build out infrastructure for manufacturing. We don't manufacture nuclear power plants. We manufacture fuel, and we manufacture reactor internals and some other componentry for nuclear power plants, the instrumentation and control systems, but we don't intend to vertically integrate Westinghouse to deliver small modular reactors or even large reactors. So just so that's clear, it'll be others within the supply chain that will be prompted to build out the necessary infrastructure to deliver the components that are necessary. But with that, in our particular design, there really isn't other than standing up structural module fabrication facilities, there really isn't a great need for new infrastructure. It's just a matter of aggregating the components and the parts and pieces at the right points and at the right times to bring all those together for delivery to a particular customer. But we don't intend to build out any additional infrastructure to do that type of activity, Rod.
Thank you. I think I'm going to turn to a combination here of Cannon and David to help me understand or help the audience understand what drove you to choose to go to Canada vice the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And I think most of the people who are on the call may understand some of the considerations, but please help us understand that.
Okay, David LeBlanc here. Maybe I'll lead off. In regard to our decision on where, what market to approach first, it was a fairly simple choice. Our Canadian regulatory system is much more, it's much more performance-based as opposed to the NRC. We have innovative technology. It's very different than light water reactor technology. Expecting the NRC to adopt, to change, I think they've got a big enough challenge trying to accommodate sodium or lead cooling or even helium cooling. We just really foresaw a very long pathway. There's a very interesting market here in Canada. We have a lot of different areas besides base load, remote northern communities, a lot of remote mining uses, a lot of industrial heat use as well. So there was just a very big draw. Now, I would say, though, that we are definitely not putting all our eggs in one basket, so to speak. We are very interested in keeping an eye, keeping development in the U.S. as well. But the experience we've had with the Canadian regulatory system to date has been very encouraging. So it just seems a better path that way. I'm not sure, Canada, if you wanted to add anything.
I think that says it. But just to briefly add, I mean, it really comes down to the time frames in which one can accomplish the licensing process, and the investigation that we did. We looked at a number of different jurisdictions around the world, and ultimately settled back on Canada. That in the USA, it was simply going to be a time frame that was not going to be compatible with investors' requirements for returns on a timely basis. And as I said earlier, if you want to fund a new nuclear technology in private industry, you need to provide returns in a suitable time frame. And if you go through the NRC, our experience is that was not going to work. And if we go through the CNSC, it will. So it's in that sense, from the investor's point of view, that was the obvious choice.
And that's very important, because the old adage of time is money is very true when you're spending, you know, even on the low end, NuScale said they're spending $12 million a month. And you're not actually even building anything. You're still got a bunch of people who are doing a lot of heavy design work and testing programs, but no construction yet. If I'm not mistaken, I believe there's a group of people in eastern Georgia who are spending something on the order of $4 million a day building new nuclear plants. So, yeah, things that take longer can add an awful lot to the cost. All right, so we've talked a little bit about the the challenge of licensing reactors in the United States, what are some of the things that you all would like to see different or modified to enable construction of safe, effective, and economically feasible reactors here in the U.S.? And I'm going to start with Pear, because you've done some a lot of research on the methodologies used to get the NRC to understand what new technologies have come to the table. So start us off with, what do we need to do to change our licensing?
Well, Rod, that's a really important question. And the first thing to point out is that the only country to date to license reactors using passive safety, it has been the United States. If you look around the world and look at what the French, the South Koreans, the Japanese, and even the Chinese, the new reactor designs coming out of those countries, they all continue to use the active safety systems that are, diesel generators, the whole set of things that can be described through simplistic event trees and such. So the Canadian regulatory authority is also very competent. And the key question with regulation is, how do you transition towards more performance-based framework that enables you to use good quality analysis and more modern tools? And in the U.S., the development of code scaling, applicability, and uncertainty analysis has been a major factor in the ability to qualify codes through verification validation processes using separate effect and integral effect test data, very similar to what Westinghouse is very familiar with, this NuScale certainly, and other SMR vendors are familiar with this. So that you can actually use results from these codes to predict how reactors will respond to accidents and use that information in licensing. So I think that's one of the key elements that we need to further incentivize. And when we start to look at where there are some significant remaining problems, they tend to be associated with places where the NRC and probably other regulatory agencies also will end up using deterministic requirements rather than performance-based. So, for example, on the question of control room staffing for a multi-unit SMR station, in airplanes, the FAA has a very clear performance-based requirement for how many pilots you need, how many crew members you need on an airplane, because they don't want to discourage the safety benefits that come from having a larger number of smaller engines on an airplane. But for the USNRC, you've got a very deterministic requirement for how many people have to be in a control room. And how do you move past that point? Because if you can't address these issues where we have prescriptive regulatory requirements, then you can't move forward to actually improve the safety of the technology that we're working with. So one of the things that I see in the current situation is that the work that the SMR vendors are doing, NuScale, Westinghouse, and others, to push forward these regulatory questions and to address them for control room staffing, other things associated with going to power generation that involves larger numbers of smaller generators is really critical. And doing a good job there will have an enormous impact going forward in terms of how we think about nuclear power. Because when you start looking at developing and building smaller reactors, there's an additional value that comes from the fact that you can add your capacity in smaller increments, but scale it to be quite large. And the best company that's done that to date and shown that it has an enormous effect is SpaceX. Their Falcon 9 rocket has 9 engines, and it has had tremendous performance. They had one of their launches where one of the engines experienced a failure. No problem. They were able to manage it, shut it down safely, and still get to the International Space Station with no problems. So I think that the key thing we need to look at is where are these remaining deterministic requirements that say the USNRC and other regulatory agencies are still wed to, and where is it strategically important for us to push to develop more performance-based approaches? Final thing I would note is that ASME boil and pressure vessel code and all of the civil engineering codes that govern how you do modular construction and how you design civil structures, there's a huge number of opportunities to make improvement in those areas, and it requires a lot of effort to do that. But if we can, we can get to the point where we can develop better and more innovative reactor systems.
Thanks, Per. And Mike, I know that you all have been engaging with the NRC, I think, since 2008. Is that correct? Can you share a little bit about the process that you all are doing, this pre-application process, and what, I mean, I know now that you're almost finished with the pre-application process, the tendency might be to say, well, we've made it through, we're not going to make it any easier for those behind us, but can you share what you all have learned and what you think should be different the next time somebody brings a really good design to the NRC?
Well, sure. I mean, obviously, we've made as an industry a tremendous amount of progress to have come from the day when we had a Part 50 system where you designed a plant and built the plant and then licensed what you built. And to now in the Part 52 process where you receive a design certification and then a license for construction and operation of a plant, and then you build what was licensed. And that's a big difference, and we think that's a tremendous amount of progress. As you mentioned, we've been involved with our pre-application work since April of 2008 when we took out our NRC project number and began spending what's today $280 an hour for every hour of NRC time that we expend reviewing our design. So we think the time that we spend developing our pre-application work and topical reports, which are tantamount to a subset of the design certification application that gets submitted to the NRC, reviewed by them, and ruled upon by them, such that when our design cert application goes in, there will be parts of it that we've effectively agreed on how they will be reviewed beforehand. It's a very expensive process, no matter how you do it, and we would prefer to have some pre-agreement before we submit it. For those of you who are just embarking upon this process, you know, hold on to your hats and checkbooks, because you know our application will be about 12,000 pages long. It will have about 22 chapters. I think we have about 55% of the application complete. It'll be submitted in 2016, second half of 2016, and we expect that the process for review will require 39 months. That's the schedule that we have with the NRC. So 39 months from the second half of 16 puts us to a received certified design in early 2020, which should be followed shortly thereafter by a construction operating license for our customer, allowing them to commence safety-related construction. It took years to change the Part 50 process to a Part 52 process. Without that change, we wouldn't be building the AP1000s today, because no large utility would make the decision to enter into that long process without some certainty that they would come out of the back end and be able to turn the plant on and make megawatts. even with the lengthy delays that we're experiencing in South Carolina and Georgia, at least when the plant is done, both of those customers already have a license to operate the plant. They don't have to wait later for permission to operate what they will have already built and sunk, you know, tens of billions of dollars into. I think it's a really, really long putt to try and revise the NRC licensing process. The process is what it is. It's best to work through it. For us, a very key part of it is the design-specific review standard. The design-specific review standard is a new concept recently being implemented that is effectively a handshake between the NRC and the applicant about what an acceptable application should look like. We all saw the ESBWR and the AP1000, take 9 or 10 years to go through the process and, 18 or 19 amendments. We don't intend to be in that kind of a situation. We intend to spend a lot of that effort in the many, many years leading up to when we submit our application. I hope that answered your question. That was a little bit of a long answer.
No, that's okay. It is a complex process. Obviously, a very good change would be if for somehow the applicant could maybe finance those costs and pay them back after they get some revenue coming from these design certifications. But
well, you got to come up with the money somewhere, and we're $300 million into this thing. We've got another $600 or $700 million to go, and fortunately we have a $27 billion company that owns us and $217 million of DOE awards to help us along the way. Yep. But it is not for someone with a small checkbook.
No, agreed. Jacob, your plant or your micro reactor, it sounds like you'd have to sell an awful lot of units before you could make up the cost of getting a license here in the U.S. What's your thought process? Because I would imagine many of your markets are overseas.
Right. You're absolutely correct. and that's one of the things where we're at right now is surveying, working with people who have expressed interest, very serious interest, in buying these reactors and financing them as part of new development projects, and working with where are the most promising geographies, and then what is the regulatory structure there. Thankfully, there's a lot of interest in places like the U.S., places like Canada, where there's an well-established nuclear infrastructure. But one of the challenges we face is there's also a lot of interest in some areas that really do not have the established nuclear infrastructure at all. And that's something where, of course, we can't go there until there's something set up faster, or set up in place. Thankfully, we've seen how that can work when we look at what the UAE was able to do and how they proceeded. And one of the lessons I think that was interesting there was they required that the Korean designs that they are going with live up to certain or meet certain U.S. requirements. And I think that sets a good benchmark to do that. But that's something that is a concern for us. In sense of how do we navigate in certain areas where this would be a big benefit to have, where there's not to have our reactors in their places, but there's not necessarily that infrastructure. And are there ways to establish some kinds of international procedures and processes that could help there? That's something that, we're not going to be able to achieve and do on our own, because I would say that's an even longer putt than just restructuring the regulatory system in the U.S. But hopefully, as we get some success building these in areas with infrastructure that can be developed, because it does take time. The other part, like you said, is being small and how do you generate the revenue to pay it back. One of the benefits for us is that we can sell power at a higher price. Some of the markets we're in, we can basically build the reactor, operate the reactor, sell the power back. At a much higher price than what you would see anywhere in the U.S., for example, on grid in the U.S. And that helps to change the economic paradigm quite a bit. So all of a sudden, each reactor becomes worth a lot more than it would seem if you're going off of on-grid power prices. But the good news is that those savings actually do add up pretty quickly when you talk about a site with, for example, six reactors. And the savings that we realize for them for diesel, it also makes it a justifiable investment for the customers. And that kind of helps offset some of the licensing hurdles. One of the things that we anticipate being the case for us is that we're going to have to basically prioritize where we focus our licensing efforts on where the first lead is. It'd be great if there was a process where if you got a license in the U.S. or in Canada and you wanted to take it to the other country, for example, it was sort of a streamlined, faster process. Of course, that isn't the case now. So that kind of limits how far you can spread yourself, of course. And so that's one of the things that we're really focused on right now is who's going to be the first mover on this and where do we focus our efforts so that we can, stretch a dollar as far as we can, especially in light of sort of what our business model is. But the economics do work out well for us to not have to sell, 500 reactors to achieve sort of payback on the licensing. We can do it a lot faster than that.
Thank you. And thank you for opening up another line of questioning. I wrote a piece this morning about a group called, or it included some discussion about a group from the World Nuclear Association called Cooperation in Reactor Design, Evaluation, and Licensing, CORDEL, which is a group that is working on a concept of international licensing for small modular reactors that would be much more akin to the way that we license ships or aircraft to operate in different countries without having to go through a country-by-country process. Anybody have any thoughts on how that would help their business models? I'll start with maybe David.
Yeah, David LeBlanc here. If it's feasible, I'm certainly in favor of such a model. I think over the years, a lot of us have kind of batted that idea back and forth. Could the IAEA in some possible way play a role? It seems maybe a little far-fetched, though, but I think that idea, since we all are aiming to make reactors, and on this conversation here in North America, we want to build them here first, but we all know our market is more the rest of the world. So that idea of in every single situation going to yet another national regulator and going through the process is a bit daunting. If they are making any sort of headway in that idea, it's quite exciting to me.
Mike, you guys are focused on the U.S. and you've got a long runway of people that are already expressing interest here. Are you interested in the international market as well?
Yes, we are, Rod. It's a really interesting discussion. We have dialogue ongoing with a number of other international clients, as well as the 11 or 12 that we have a line of sight for here in the U.S. It's an interesting history, and one of the previous speakers mentioned, what was going on in the UAE with respect to the Korea design. It's really important to note that the UAE did make it a very important factor that the Korean design become considered in U.S. regulatory space, and that design was rejected. Now, it's not going to stop. It was rejected by the U.S. NRC. Now, it's not going to stop the UAE from moving forward, but the UAE wants to see the U.S. NRC approval of that design because it's largely viewed worldwide as sort of the gold standard for nuclear regulation. The same holds true for the Chinese development of the AP1000. The Chinese were adamant that the AP1000 become certified in the United States, and it was a key part of the discussions between their procurement of the technology and ultimately development of the technology in China. So our international clients while they may have their own regulatory space, they feel much more comfortable with our technology coming to their regulatory space with the U.S. NRC design certification seal of approval. That's why our first efforts are to accomplish the design certification here in the United States, because we believe that it provides us the springboard for licensing in places like China, in Canada, in the UK, and other places where we have a customer group that has told us that.
Yeah, and I want to clarify a little bit. I'm pretty sure, and I'm not positive about this, but I'm pretty sure that the South Korean design application was filed with the NRC, and they didn't docket it because they said it was not an acceptable application, and told the South Koreans to go back and fix the application. They haven't really rejected the technology. They haven't really done a review on it, as far as I know.
I think that's exactly right. That's my understanding as well.
Yeah. So I also was in a meeting one time where there were some people who were pretty shocked when they found out that the NRC had rejected that application, because they had been involved in the preparation and said it was probably one of the best applications the NRC ever received, but they needed to somehow set a standard for what they mean when they say, when you bring us an acceptable application, we can get the review done in 39 months. Anyway.
Right, that's why we feel so strongly about the design-specific review standard and the value of that.
Yep, yeah, because that timeline is predicated on a lot of assumptions, and as you mentioned, Mike, it took Westinghouse, I actually counted as saying somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 years to go from starting the design of a passively cooled system before they actually got a design certification that they could start building, because they started the design work in 1986 and started building their first unit here in the U.S. in 2012. So there was a lot of – that includes the AP600, by the way. So, Robin, I'm not trying to bash on Westinghouse. I'm just thinking about the length of the process it takes here. Cannon, I want to ask you a little bit. You know, you said you did a pretty extensive personal financial survey of the landscape. What are some of the things that got you really interested in nuclear to begin with, and what are some of the hurdles that you see besides the time that we've already talked about? How can we take the potential of this technology and package it in such a way that people can actually make enough money on it to keep it going?
Yeah, good question. As I said, I conducted an analysis, and there really was very little out there that I could find that was actually that proposed a positive, economically viable investment proposal. So looking at it from that perspective, it was very difficult. In terms of developing something that is that would be economically viable, I mean, the one thing besides time, as you say, the one thing that would be extremely useful is if the capital expenditure for the project would be greatly diminished. I mean, I think we all recognize the fact that one of the biggest criticisms of nuclear power is that critics say it's very expensive. The critics don't tend to look at it in terms of the lifetime of the plant and then compare it to say a natural gas plant. They point towards what they are focusing on. All their attention on is the capital expenditure. If you can take that capital expenditure and make it much smaller, then you have something which is more attractive, and I think that's obviously the reason why SMRs have become the latest focus of the industry. That's a very good reason. I mean, it's the whole point is to try to get the CapEx down. Other than that, I mean, I would say, you know, we sort of had a little bit of a discussion just now on this, but if there was a way that the industry could somehow be standardized, I read William Tucker's book, Terrestrial Energy, and I remember being shocked when I was reading about how the user interfaces in the control rooms, there was no control room which was the same as any other control room in all the reactors in the U.S. You guys probably know more about that than I do, but I mean that just blew my mind. I mean, why for a technology that is that's so complex, I mean, why wouldn't you want to standardize it? Why wouldn't you want to create a global standard and you know, take some capital pressures away? I mean, that's what the industry needs. Certainly, the industry must be able to recognize that fact and do something about it.
Sure. Yeah, this is Mike McGew. You know, we've got, I think, 99 remaining operating reactors. I've been inside of the control room of all but two of those. And I can tell you they are all different. And it does stem from the fact that the plants are all different as well. The control rooms, you know, we're dealing with analog control rooms, and the control rooms of the future are going to be digital. It's going to be much easier if you go to our website and look at what our control looks like. It's a set of screens, and it's much easier to standardize those screens. In fact, we modify the screens as we're working through the design. It can be modified in a matter of hours, where if you were doing that in analog space and having to move switches and valves and strip charts and buttons, it'd be an enormous endeavor. So, you know, I feel your pain. I mean, you're exactly right. And as a 36-year, you know, veteran of this industry, it has been one of the banes of the industry. The new scale design will be completely standardized, and everything can be built in a factory and installed or uninstalled if there should be an issue in complete sort of plug-and-play fashion.
This is fair. Yeah, I think... add another thought, which is that if you want to think about international standards, the responsibility for reactor safety really is explicitly at the national level. But the European pressurized reactor is an example of what happens if you just try to homogenize French and German standards. I'm quite concerned that an international standard will end up creating a very large number of deterministic requirements just to please everybody. So I think that we do have to actually work through the most competent national regulatory authorities to if we're going to be able to deploy reactors that are truly licensed based on performance-based requirements rather than deterministic and prescriptive requirements.
That would be.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, I spent 4.5 years of my career on the EPR and did see an awful lot of things where, you know, engineers gone wild for redundant safety trains, two containments, none of which were given credit in regulatory space. You know, the economics don't make a lot of sense when you get into that kind of situation.
Yeah, and the EPR also shows you the consequences of trying to scale to sizes which are extraordinarily large in terms of the capability to build the plants in a reasonable period of time.
Well,
and the act of safety requires so much additional control because of all of the additional equipment. It is not the correct direction to go if you want to encourage innovation.
Yeah, as I told your students, Per, one of the big challenges you have when you add redundancy is everything you add to the system, you have to control it, you have to qualify it, you have to test it, you have to maintain it, and it adds cost. And also, there is a significant diseconomy of scale when you have to build something that is bigger than anything else you've built before. And that is one of the things I'm researching right now is the Westinghouse AP1000s, even the ones in China right now, are being delayed by the fact that the reactor coolant pumps, which are a design that has been built similar, but they're the biggest ones ever built, the reactor coolant pumps are not performing. And so they're having to go back and be shipped all the way back from China to the U.S. to be remanufactured and shipped back. So, you know, that's a big diseconomy of scale. And, you know, as a supplier, can you imagine if you were going to be responsible for adding delays to a project that is spending $4 million a day?
Yeah, that can be really painful. And sorry. This is Mike. Yeah, that can be painful. And then one of the reasons the new scale design is eliminated, we do not have reactor coolant pumps. Our flow requires three things to work: convection, conduction, and gravity. And those things work all the time, no matter what. So we have gone to great lengths to eliminate those requisite mechanical components that can become difficult to design and build.
This is Per. I would agree with that. I would emphasize how valuable Westinghouse's transition to canned pumps is, which eliminates seals and eliminates leakage. And this has a wide range of implications. The challenges in scaling these components up to larger size are substantial, but in the case of the AP1000, which is likely to be deployed in large numbers all across the world because of its passive safety, its modular fabrication, so that particularly in export markets, AP1000 is not strongly dependent on your labor force in the way that conventional reactors are because of the degree of modularization and the reduction in skill levels needed for the site labor. I really hope that Westinghouse can work through these questions on these can pumps because it was the correct technology direction. But it illustrates this key point, which is that when you have very large plants that have multiple billion dollars in capital at risk related to being able to start them up, That's a very challenging thing to do. And with the small reactors where the capital at risk is smaller, you can afford to take more risk. You can even afford to license your first few under Part 50 as opposed to 52 and then seek a design certification a bit later on. And this is the reason that I think that it's really important for us to devote effort in the U.S. and to encourage international effort to see multi-unit SMR station technology developed and deployed, because it will help to accelerate further innovation, including transition towards higher temperatures, alternate coolants, advanced fuel cycles, and all of those things that can make nuclear even more attractive.
Which brings up the final, well, this is going to be the final question because I promised some people that I wasn't going to take them all night. What I want to ask, and this came up in the meeting that I mentioned at the very introduction in December when people were testifying to Congress on what would make things easier. The first nuclear age was partly enabled by a wild an innovative and creative time when places like the National Reactor Testing Station in Idaho allowed people to build 20, 30, 40 different demonstration reactors that they could fully test. What would you say if the U.S. took some of its existing assets at, say, maybe Savannah River Site, Idaho National Laboratory, maybe even Hanford, and designated some space where private industry could come and build a full-scale demonstration plant that would then allow them to have something to show to customers? And maybe the government wouldn't necessarily pay for the design and development, but they could certainly give you a space and maybe pay the security costs. What's the reaction that you all would have to something like that?
This is Per. I think having the space and security would be very helpful. But I think it's really important to emphasize also that with passive safety, the building structures and the reactors operate as an integrated unit. So the idea of having sort of like a super containment that you can put anything in and test, I'm not sure that that's really the best approach, as opposed to having some space inside a laboratory with skilled labor, with electrical capabilities, you know, and other assets to build a prototype. But some of the suggestions have been that you need to have some sort of a building that you put these things inside of. And I'm skeptical about that, because the integration of the buildings with the reactors is central to implementing passive safety.
Oh, I'm not suggesting putting it inside a building. I'm suggesting using the 600 some odd square miles of land that is Idaho National Laboratory or Savannah Riverside, and, you know, mainly, you know, I think Mike tells me that he needs something on the order of 40 acres for a complete 12 module unit. That's not a very big percentage of a square mile.
And that's exactly the right direction to be going. There's all sorts of benefits that come from building prototypes in an area where you have the technical expertise, the transmission capacity, and that sort of thing. So NuScale is certainly going in the correct direction, I think, and that is a good model.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is Mike McGue speaking. I mean, the NuScale prototype that we've been running since 2003 was funded as per referred to as the MASLR, the Multi-Application Small Light Water Reactor, the original name of the NuScale design. That was funded by a small DOE grant of $2 or $3 million back in 2000. So there is precedent for that, and it really doesn't matter whether it's nuclear heat or electrical heat to be able to demonstrate whether the circulatory flow path and the thermodynamics of the plant will work and deliver the kind of output in terms of plant performance that's expected. Of course, there are other parts of the plant in terms of fuel design and things that need to be tested. But in our design, we're using conventional PWR fuel assemblies in conventional configurations and enrichments. So that becomes a relatively simple thing to extrapolate.
Yeah, this is Jake DeWitt.
Sorry, Ken,
go for it, please.
Go ahead, Jake.
I was just going to add to what Mike said, and just the fact that I think, and what Per said, is the fact that if you can have the ability to build prototypes and approach this sort of development and licensing by testing, I don't mean that as a specific rule. I just mean that as more of a philosophy and an approach to design and development. I think that helps everybody, and it helps spur innovation at a much faster scale. And the land available and the infrastructure resources and know-how at the labs provides a great opportunity, I think, to sort of shift into that direction. Also, if that was the case, and you could build things in a more streamlined or simpler way and take advantage of pre-qualifications of the site and security, if in the case that you need to do nuclear testing, you know, you can attract private capital to do that, and it would actually ease, I think, the attraction of private capital to tackle some of those problems. So I think it's a great opportunity to pursue. I think and I think the kind of the examples that have been how we did this back in the 50s, 60s, 70s when we built reactors is kind of an example of how it's really valuable to learn by doing. So
This is Mike McGue again. I mean, I would just suggest this. I mean, the AP1000s that are being built now were licensed initially on a design certification as an AP600, then an AP1000 by Dr. Jose Reyes and the team at Oregon State University, who designed and built the NuScale prototype. In the olden days, we used to have to build a scaled nuclear heated prototype for the licensing. That is no longer the case. It has been proven, and the Westinghouse AP1000s were certified based on an electrically heated 1/4 scale prototype. So there's no need. I mean, it's a hell of a lot more expensive to go build a nuclear heated prototype than it is to build a non-nuclear heated prototype with proven scaling factors. So
sure,
I mean, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars.
I completely agree. I completely agree. That's how you do it. But when you're going towards technologies, materials, fuels that aren't PWR assemblies, that are a little bit off, that haven't had the irradiation experience, it would be really valuable to do that, especially when the NRC asks for data on performance of certain fuel forms that just haven't spent enough time in reactors. It'd be a way to streamline and maybe ease getting into those reactors. You know, not
that's
I think you're right.
Great
starting
point.
With,
great point.
Starting with electric heating is absolutely the way to go when you're talking about showing the thermal transport capabilities and cooling performance. And honestly, you, like you said, NuScale and then the team, you know, that made NuScale with the AP1000 scale up, prove that beautifully. So I think it's a good roadmap that's been built for that.
Yeah, as long as you're using a PWR fuel or light water reactor fuel.
Save yourself as much money as you can, as early as you can.
Yep. Mm-hmm. All right.
Rod, it's Cannon. Go ahead, Cannon. It's Cannon here. If I could just chime in quickly on that one. I think there's a broader point to be made. I'm not American, but I know a little bit about the history of the Manhattan Project. And I believe the situation was that the government threw a vast sum of resources at a perceived threat at the time. And I believe that at this particular moment in time, the U.S. is facing a tremendous threat. You have a crumbling grid infrastructure. You have an aging coal fleet. You have an aging nuclear fleet. And you are moving more and more towards dependence on natural gas, which is, it's cheap now, but even the DOE itself is projecting an increase in gas prices in the next 10 to 15 years to north of $8. So the way I see it, you know, the U.S. has, at this particular moment in time, maybe 10 or 20 years to wean itself to some extent off of coal and gas. And if I were the president, I would take this opportunity to create a new Manhattan Project, which revolves around developing new nuclear technology and having it ready to go by the time gas is $8. The country can be in a position where potentially, you know, you could switch a big part of the grid over to new nuclear.
And that's why he gave us $217 million, is he expects us to be in exactly that position.
Yeah, but Mike, in the energy business, $270 million is decimal dust. So
Trust me, it means a lot to us.
I know, but I was a financial guy for the U.S. Navy, and like I said, it's spread over 5 or 6 years. Is that right?
Yes, 5 years. That's correct.
Okay, so again, CapEx for a single company like ExxonMobil is on the order of $30 billion a year to find more natural gas and oil. So, the idea of spending a few hundred million dollars over the course of 5 years, and by the way, in December of 2014, the U.S. Congress passed something that they called a 3-week extension of the production tax credit for wind. What it really was making it retroactive for the entire year of 2014. That any wind project started before December 31st could qualify for the production tax credit, which really isn't the production tax credit because nobody takes it in that manner anymore. They take it as a investment tax credit. There's an option that still keeps getting pushed in. It's very hard to find. The investment tax credit costs the U.S. taxpayers over $6 billion for wind turbines that were already built anyway in 2014. So that's just one of my pet peeves, that somehow Congress can figure out at the last few weeks of the year how to spend another $6 billion to subsidize things that were already built anyway, and can't figure out how to enable nuclear to go forward. And maybe by doing something silly like, oh, paying the NRC's bills themselves. But, you know, whatever. You know, 90% of the NRC's budget comes from fees, and yet the NRC's budget is appropriated as if it's coming out of taxpayer funds every year. So if you go to the NRC and says, I really want you to put a press on getting our design-specific review package out, and I'm willing to pay you the cost, they'll say, well, we can't add any more people to it because our budget was approved 2 years ago, and all the people is all we've got. So, all right.
Rod, yes. This is Per. Just a quick point. I sat on a commission. One of our key recommendations is that the federal government should provide funds. Congress needs to provide funds to the NRC, at least 10-20% of their budget, which is clearly directed to enabling, to working to make it easier to submit license applications for advanced reactors, and that's clearly. And then when you get to these huge subsidies for production tax credits for mature technologies, which wind turbines these days actually are. That's also unconscionable. So I agree with you on both points.
Yeah, I'll close with this, but the idea of paying the NRC to get ready to review advanced reactors is, I believe, something that should be done on a national level, and not expect that a small company like Jacobs Company can come up with an innovative design that can be analyzed as being physically safe by people who are experts at that design, and now they have to turn to the NRC, which right now its expertise is fairly well limited to light water reactor technologies, and they have to spend their money teaching the NRC reviewers how to review their design. And they have to pay the NRC $280 an hour to sit in class, and that's, you know, that's the challenge that we have is, you know, the NRC should be looking ahead, saying what's on the horizon, you know, getting the best reviewers it can get, bringing on the right skill sets, having their own classes. And somehow you don't want to charge the operating utilities for that. That's not their job to pay for that service. And, you know, it's really hard to justify paying for that service as a startup with a great idea, an innovative idea. I mean, the molten salt reactor guys are going to have to do the same thing because the NRC really doesn't understand fluid-fueled reactors very well, if at all. So, hey, thank you all for participation. It's been almost 90 minutes. I hope that you all enjoyed this and that I haven't worn out my welcome with these fine participants. Next time I'll try to get a few more voices on here maybe I'll get a list of questions that they want me to ask. But I hope that you all found some value here. And thank you very much for being available on the Sunday evening to do this, especially Mike McGew.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Thanks very much,
good night, everyone. Okay, bye.
I hope you all enjoyed that show. I found it fascinating to talk to these innovators and exciting to believe that there's this many people who can see the potential of nuclear energy and how it can help make the world a better place, help make America a stronger economic power. If you like this kind of programming and you want to hear more of it, it's always good to help support the capability that enables me to do this. So there's a donate button on the head front page of the Atomic Insights blog. And whatever you think is valuable to you, please give a little bit to the cause. Allow Atomic Insights to be more active, go more places, talk to more people, and produce more good information that can help make the process better, influence the NRC, maybe even help find some politicians who will grab hold of this issue and take it on because they believe in the power of energy to make the world a better place, especially energy that's concentrated, reliable, and clean. Take care. Hope you enjoyed. Bye now.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.